and it gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Roy Shulman.
Thanks, Al.
God bless you.
Thanks. Peace. Hi. It's great to be here. As Al's introduction kind of intimated, there were a couple of themes there introduced. I think I'd better start with my conversion story and how I got here, and then maybe I'll be able to go in a little bit to the theme that Al also introduced of the relationship between Judaism and Catholicism and the way in which salvation is from the Jews. But let me just kind of start at the beginning, I hope and pray that I do all of this to the honor and glory of our Blessed Mother. As Al said, I was born of, my parents are German-Jewish Holocaust refugees. They escaped Hitler's Germany. My father escaped just when Hitler came to power, when the Jews were still allowed to leave as long as they left all their possessions behind. My mother wasn't so fortunate, and she got caught up. She fled Germany to France, but then she got caught up in France under the occupation. And she was actually on a train to go to a concentration camp. She was taken off the train for interrogation because the Gestapo thought she might know something about a smuggling network. She convinced them that she didn't know anything about the smuggling network, but she actually escaped the night before she was due to be put on the continuation of the train to the camp. They settled in the New York City area. That's where I was born. I was raised quite observant Jewish. Being Jewish was not only the center of my life, but it was also the center of my identity. I was very devout growing up. I went to a Jewish religious education all the way, starting from when school started, when I was five, and all the way through to the end of high school. I had a real Jewish love of God, and maybe I'll have a chance to talk about that too, because what my whatever it is, apostolate or ministry, is all about is actually all about the conversion of the Jews, but mostly it's about praying for the conversion of the Jews. And I can certainly attest as a Jew that if there is a Jewish characteristic, if there's a good Jewish, the best Jewish characteristic is a particular love and devotion to God, which can only be fulfilled in Christ. I mean, it's a hunger for Christ, which is what the Jews were created for, right? Because they were essentially created to pray for the coming of the Messiah and to host him when he came, to the people among whom he came. So I had that hunger for God, although of course it wasn't fulfilled in Christianity yet. In the summer, even between high school and college, let me back up a little bit. In late high school years, I even started living and traveling with a Hasidic rabbi. The Hasids are the ultra-Orthodox Jews with the long ear curls and the black Aberdeen coats. And I even toyed with the idea of, instead of going to college, essentially entering Jewish religious life and just making that my life, a life of prayer and study. But I decided not to. I went to MIT instead. And soon after I got to MIT, the religiosity actually faded. And it faded the way I think faith and devotion usually fades, which is with the fall from a state of grace and the introduction of sin. This was MIT circa 1969 to 73. You know, I was a normal college student following the mode of life of those days. And I pretty quickly lost that state of grace, and with that, lost my sense of the presence of God. And so by the end of MIT, I was essentially atheist, agnostic. I went on to Harvard Business School. I did very well at Harvard Business School. I was invited, I went into consulting for a year, but then I was recruited by the faculty of Harvard Business School to come back and join the faculty. So I found myself on the faculty of Harvard Business School at the ripe old age of 29. And that's really, in some sense, where my conversion story begins. Because what had gone on, what had happened was really, all my life, I had basically had this hunger inside for God and for something that really mattered. And I kept thinking that at the next stage of my life, I will finally fall into what really matters, you know, what gives life its real meaning. And of course, as a child, I thought that when I grow up or when I go to college, you know, then my life will start to have real meaning. Then it was when I started my career. Then it was, when I get into Harvard Business School or when I, get a faculty position or whatever. And here I had gotten all of those things, and my life still didn't have any real meaning. There was still no real point to anything. But the difference was, at this point, there was nothing more to hope for. There was no more brass ring out there, no more external goal to strive for in the hopes that when I achieved that, life would have real meaning. So at the same time that I was kind of externally at the high point of my life, I was internally at the low point, because I had achieved everything that I thought there was to achieve, and there was still no point to anything. And it was in that state of a really kind of existential despair that I received the by far the greatest single grace of my life. In those days, the only place I could really find solace, remember, I was essentially atheist, agnostic. I didn't believe in God, certainly didn't pray, but I found my greatest solace walking alone in nature, just kind of lost in my thoughts, letting the beauty of creation kind of assuage the pain or the despair. And that's what I was doing early one morning. I was walking in the woods behind the beach in Cape Cod, and just alone walking on a path with just the birds singing. It was probably about 7:30 in the morning. When, from one moment to the next, the only way I can really describe it is I fell into heaven. From one moment to the next, I found myself very immediately and knowingly in the presence of God, looking at my life as though I were looking at my life from after death in the presence of God. And from one moment to the next, I saw I saw everything. I saw that... Where should I start? I saw that my two greatest regrets when I died would be all of the time and energy I wasted not being loved, when every moment of my existence I was being held in an ocean of love greater than I could imagine, coming from this all-knowing, all-loving God. And the other great regret would be every hour that I wasted doing nothing of value in the eyes of heaven. I saw that everything I ever did had a moral content that mattered for all eternity. I saw that everything I ever did was recorded, and I would either be pleased about it or somewhat regretful about it for all eternity. I saw that everything that had ever happened to me had been the most perfect thing that could have been arranged to happen to me, coming from the hand of this all-knowing, all-loving God, especially those things which had caused the most suffering at the time, and which I had thought of as the greatest disasters at the time. I saw, of course, from one moment to the next, that my life, in fact, had so much more meaning than I had ever hoped, had an infinity of meaning, because every moment of our existence is an opportunity, I don't want to sound corny, but sort of, to add a pearl to the necklace of all eternity. To do something of value in the eyes of heaven, which will matter for all eternity. And I knew from one moment to the next the meaning and purpose of my life was to worship and serve this God who was revealing himself to me. And I prayed on the spot to know his name so I would know what religion to follow. Frankly, I couldn't associate him with the God that I thought of the Old Testament, the kind of very vindictive, angry, one slip and you're vaporized kind of an image I had of God. I'm sorry. I must have misunderstood something, but if you read the Old Testament, you can understand why I might have had that wrong impression. So I prayed to know his name, and I remember, I'm tempted to say standing there, but actually I was still walking, praying to know his name, and I remember praying, "Lord, let me know your name so I know what religion to follow. I don't mind if you're Apollo and I have to become a Roman pagan. I don't mind if you're Buddha and I have to become a Buddhist. I don't mind if you're Krishna and I have to become Hindu. As long as you're not Christ and I have to become Christian." maybe I can talk, when I talk tomorrow, maybe I can talk a little more about where that was coming from. But frankly, if any of you know any Jews, you might have some idea of where it was coming from. There's an incorrect sense that Christianity, a sense of being under siege by Christianity, a sense of Christianity being the greatest disaster that ever befell Judaism, that it's because of Christianity that the Jews have never been left in peace and so forth. So I prayed that, And he respected that prayer. He didn't tell me who he was. But I was, in some sense, I was happy for the first time in my life, or since early childhood. And I went back to Cambridge, where I was living and working. And I went back, in some sense, happy for the first time in my life. I knew my life had a meaning and purpose. I was determined to pursue this, to find out more about this, to find out who this was, and to dedicate my life to him. So the first task was to figure out who he was and what religion this was. Well, I got back to Cambridge, and what do I do, okay? This was, in my mind, this was a mystical experience, right? It certainly seemed like a mystical experience. And what do you do if you have a mystical experience and you try to figure out what's going on? You find someone who thinks they're a mystic to talk to, right? Which wasn't a very prudent thing to do in Cambridge in the early 1980s. So I looked up a guy that I had actually worked with, he was a temp typist at one of the consulting firms where I worked, who I knew was a self-styled mystic. He was a Kabbalist. He was a fallen away Catholic, by the way. And I said, you know, do you know anything about mysticism, or, you know, do you have any practical experience, or is it all theoretical? And he said, oh, by all means, come over. So I went over. I hoped that I could tell him my experience and be put on the right path. Well, it didn't happen the way I thought it was going to happen. I told him my experience, and he put me on all the wrong paths. He gave me terrible books to read. He started me getting involved with a group that he was involved with, which is essentially a Hindu-based, you know, guru-based meditation group. But something else happened that night. When I was over at his apartment, he went in the kitchen to fix some tea, and I was sitting in the living room, and he had a coffee table, and on the coffee table, he had a coffee table book. And the book was called something like The 100 Greatest Miracles of Modern Times, and it was just like a page on all of these spectacular miracles. So I'm leafing through the book, and my eye catches the miracle of Fatima. Now, I had never heard of Fatima. I mean, I had degrees from MIT and Harvard, right? And I was pretty smart, and no one had ever bothered to tell me about Fatima. So, again, let me exhort you to talk about these things. So I see this thing about Fatima, and my friend Bob comes back from the kitchen, and I say, you know, is this really true? And he says, yes. And I say, well, has anyone else ever heard of it? And he said, oh, yeah, you know, it's you know, well-known among Catholics. And I said, well, you know, like, are there any books on it or anything? And he said, yeah, just go to the public library. There'll be, you know, a dozen books on it. And I was furious. I was furious that all my life, no one had ever told me this. Here, all my life, you know, I had studied the Old Testament, right? I missed God. I kept asking, why did miracles used to happen 3,000 years ago, but miracles don't happen anymore? Nobody had ever told me this. I was furious that here there was this miracle witnessed by 80,000, 100,000 people, including atheists, communists, cynics, non-believers, witnessed by all of them, well documented, and no one had ever told me. So anyway, I didn't make the next step. I didn't even look at any of those books on Fatima. But I went home. I still followed all these wrong paths. I was, you know, involved with this Hindu meditation group. But I was still really seeking. And then I received the second really great grace, which is a year to the day after that initial experience on the beach. And I know it was a year to the day because I prayed before going to sleep in Thanksgiving. And I used to say a prayer for that year every night before going to sleep, a little prayer that I made up to know the name of my Lord and Master who had revealed himself to me that day on the beach. So I went to sleep, and I felt as though I was woken by a hand gently rocking my shoulder. Now, I know this was a dream. I know that if there was a video camera in the room, it would have shown me still asleep. But I can only describe it the way it seemed to me, the way it felt, and the way my memory represents it, which is as though I were woken by a hand on my shoulder by a guide and taken to a room and left alone in the presence of the most beautiful young woman I could imagine. And I knew without being told that it was the Blessed Virgin Mary. Just to be in her presence, just to be in the presence of the purity of an intensity of love flowing from her, was to be in a state of ecstasy greater than I imagined could exist. And my immediate reaction was I just wanted to throw myself down on my knees and honor her. As a matter of fact, my first thought was, oh my goodness, I wish I at least knew the Hail Mary. Because there had to be some way to give her the reverence, the honor that was due her. I'll talk a little more about that too. So she said that she would answer any questions I had for her. Now, I remember the feeling of standing there, just as though I were awake. I remember weighing different questions on my mind. What about this? What about this? I remember asking the questions. I remember her answers. And in fact, the first question I asked her was because there I was wanting to honor her somehow and not even knowing the Hail Mary. So the first question I asked her, in fact, was, what's your favorite prayer to you? Now, I know that if I had known the Hail Mary, I probably wouldn't have asked that. I would have just said the Hail Mary. But I think I was a little bit too proud to say, could you teach me the Hail Mary? So instead I said, what's your favorite prayer to you? And her first answer was, I love all prayers to me. But I was a little pushy. Maybe that has to do with being a New York Jew. Maybe it doesn't. So I said, oh, come on. You must love some prayers to you more than others. And she relented, and she told me a prayer. Now, the prayer was in Portuguese. I don't know a word of Portuguese. I knew it was in Portuguese without being told. This entire experience was suffused with some amount of infused knowledge. So there were a number of things that she said out loud and a number of things I just knew without being told. And I knew without being told that the prayer was in Portuguese. And I knew that it was in Portuguese in part because in Portuguese it carried the spirit of the Portuguese people who prayed it, who still had a certain childlike love and devotion to her, perhaps more than some other nationalities. I also think that it was in Portuguese in a reflection of the miracle at Fatima. And since I didn't know any Portuguese, all I could do was try to memorize the sound of it phonetically so that the next morning when I woke up, I could find out what the prayer was. And that's what I did. I just kind of repeated to myself over and over again in the first few syllables of the prayer. And then, as soon as I woke up the next morning, I wrote it down. And then when I met a Portuguese Catholic woman, I asked her to recite all the Marian prayers in Portuguese so that I could identify it. And so by the best of my ability, the prayer was Immaculate Mary, conceived without sin. Pray for us, have recourse to thee. And when I told this to the Portuguese woman, she said, oh, that's interesting. Where she comes from, that's the first prayer that mothers teach their infant children as soon as they're able to talk. And so if that's true, that would be another reason why it would be a favorite prayer person. So as I said, I asked about four or five more questions. I usually don't tell them, but since this is a Marian conference, I'm happy to tell them, except the ones that are really humiliating because they were such dumb questions. I asked her, and this was more an exclamation than it was really a question, but I said to her, how can this be? You know, you're so glorious, you're so magnificent, you're so exalted. And I will tell the truth, in my heart, it was hard to think of her as a human being. For instance, we know when angels appear, in both the Old Testament and the New Testament, like when the angel appeared to John, you know, the initial reaction is to throw himself, you know, face down on the ground and worship him. Same thing happened in the Old Testament when an angel appeared. Just in the presence of the glory and majesty of this being coming from heaven. And we know that Mary is more exalted than the highest of the angels, right? She's the queen of angels. And so it was in that spirit that I kind of, just had this sense, actually I had a desire to worship her between you and me. So I said, how can this be? You're so exalted, you're so glorious. And she looked at me kind of pityingly. She kind of looked down at me and sort of like shook her head like this and said, oh no, you don't understand anything. I'm nothing. I'm a created thing. I'm a creature. He's everything. And another question I asked her was, at this point I had figured out, right, that it was Christ on the beach and I had better get up to speed with Christianity pretty quick. And all my life I had like heard about the Holy Spirit, right? And I had no idea what the Holy Spirit was. So another question I asked her was, you know, and I apologize for this, but this is really the way I phrased it. You know, what's this business about the Holy Spirit? know, who's the Holy Spirit? And she just like looked up with an expression of melting with love, and she just said, "He's his gaze." I knew by his she meant God's gaze. And well, I'm drawing a blank, so maybe those are the questions that I meant to bring up right now. And then she said, after I had finished with my questions and the answers, she said she had something else she wanted to talk to me about. And that was really the purpose of the visit in some sense. And so she spoke to me for about another 10 or 15 minutes. Now, there's a veil over that. I knew even at the time that a veil was being dropped over that. And I have a very vague sense of kind of the theme of what was discussed, but I don't have the kind of clear recollection of it that I have of the rest of the dream. And then the audience was ended. And one more question I asked her that I remembered, so I will say, which is I asked her. Actually, this was close to the end of the questions. I asked her how she liked to be referred to, you know, what title she liked for herself. Again, this was, I feel like I should say mea culpa, but at the same time, I know how innocent I am of this. I mean, you know, it's inevitable in her presence to feel it appropriate to worship her. I know that's theologically incorrect, but the glory and the majesty is such that it's just human. So I asked her, out of that desire to honor her, how she liked to be called. And she said, "I'm the daughter of the Father, the mother of the Son, and the spouse of the Spirit." And by the way, let me just, you have no reason, right, to believe me, but, you know, I didn't know anything about Christianity at this point. I mean, this stuff was all entirely new to me. I had one heck of a catechesis that night. And the next morning when I woke up, I knew that it had been Christ on the beach. I knew that the Blessed Virgin Mary was by far the perfection of creation. I mean, the most perfect and exalted creature that God had ever exercised creation for. And I knew that I wanted nothing more than to be as good and complete a Christian as I possibly could. I still didn't know how to go about it. I didn't know what a Protestant was. I didn't know what a Catholic was. I really could do nothing but open the phone book and look for a church. So I started out at a Protestant church. As soon as I got to know the pastor, I kind of shyly said, "Well, what about the Blessed Virgin Mary?" I won't repeat his comment, but it wasn't as flattering as I thought was appropriate. And I knew this is no place for me. And there was something else going on at this time, which is, I woke up totally and helplessly in love with the Blessed Virgin Mary. As a matter of fact, I'll tell another little incident from the moment I woke up, which is, you know, I woke up the next morning, and what's my first thought is, "Oh boy, I can't wait 12 hours and I get to go to sleep again and see her again." You know, and so I can't wait, and I go to bed that night, and you know, I don't see her again, right? So I wake up the next morning and I say, "Oh well, you know, it's sure to happen at least once a week, right?" Week goes by, it doesn't happen. I say to myself, "Well, you know, at least once a month." Anyway, obviously it never happened again. And that in itself, that error of mine was a grace, because if I had known when I woke up the next morning that I would never see her again until I died, I don't know if I could have gone on. But in any case, in that longing to evoke some presence of her, I used to spend all my free time after this dream at Marian shrines. There was a shrine to Our Lady of La Salette not far from my house. I lived in Cambridge at the time. This was in Ipswich, Massachusetts. Now, La Salette isn't one of the best-known Marian apparitions. It's entirely church-approved. It was 1846, high in the French Alps. The Blessed Virgin Mary appeared to two shepherd children, Melanie and Maximin. I think she was 14 and he was 11. She gave them a message, a kind of standard message saying how much it hurts her son that people don't give him the honor that's due, they don't observe the Sabbath, They work on the Sabbath. They don't go to church. They can't drive their carts without cursing and using the name of her son in vain. And if people don't repent, a disaster will befall. So that was, and go and tell this news to all my people. It was a one-time apparition anyway. That's this kind of the story of La Salette. So I used to spend like probably 3 or 4 days a week just go to the shrine and just walk the grounds and feel a faint presence of Mary and kind of try to commune with her. And spend time at other Marian shrines too. So what happens when you're at Marian shrines is you're often present when a Mass is going on. And whenever I'd be there and a Mass was going on, I didn't really even know what was going on, except I knew I really wanted to receive communion. So those were the two things kind of going on. Then I will not exactly digress, but kind of jump ahead, I suppose. Then that following winter, at this point in my life, which is a whole other story, I was actually kind of living for downhill skiing. I was spending every winter in the Alps going downhill skiing. It's kind of a complicated story, but it was in this search for some meaning. I kind of thought that sliding really down, really fast downhill on snow was a meaning to life. So I used to always go to the Alps every winter to ski, sometimes for as much as the whole winter for 3 months. And so the following winter, I went back to the Alps to ski. And I'm in the French Alps, not far from La Salette, the original site of La Salette, which is in the French Alps. And it rains for like 3 days straight, and I'm skiing in this warm rain, which isn't very interesting. And by now, I did kind of like to be alone in beautiful places and kind of pray and meditate. So I decided I'll take a day off of skiing and I'll drive to La Salette and check it out, because it was, I knew it was 10,000 feet in the Alps, above tree line, 15 miles from the nearest village, this isolated spot. I was kind of tired of the noise and commotion of the ski area, and the skiing wasn't fun anyway. So I got in my rental car and drove there thinking it would be an hour or two away. Well, because of the roads, it took all day to get there. When I got there, it was already twilight. I came over the last knoll. Now this is high Alps. This is miles and miles past the last tree. It's nothing but granite cliffs and glaciers, essentially. And I go over this little knoll and look down in a little hollow, and there's this huge basilica glowing in the twilight. It looked just like Shangri-La, if any of you know Shangri-La. Just looked absolutely heavenly. And I drive up to it, and I see a sign saying reception. I say, oh, wow, people can stay here. I thought you'd have to be like a priest or at least a Catholic, right, to stay there. I'm still Jewish at this point. And I'm still Jewish, but that's a whole nother story. So I go up to the reception desk shyly and say, can I stay here? And they say, of course. So I say, this is great. So I get a room for the night, and I stay there the next day, just walking around there, feeling a very strong presence of Mary and praying, and figuring, well, tomorrow I can go back to skiing, right? So I get up the next morning, and I want to go back to skiing, so I get in the rental car, and I drive to the nearest ski area. Well, I had a series of disasters, one after another. I don't want to make it a real long, drawn-out story, but the final disaster was my car was broken into, the car locks were broken. I could no longer be in civilization because I didn't have a place to stay at night. I used to keep everything I had in the car and just find a place to stay from night to night. I couldn't do that if I couldn't lock my car. So I was stuck. I had to go back to La Salette. So I went back to La Salette. Then I get to La Salette, and there's this huge blizzard, and about 3 feet of snow was falling a day, and the road down from La Salette was closed, and I'm stuck for the rest of the trip at La Salette. It was like 2 weeks there. And I'll just tell a couple of stories about what happened when I was stuck at La Salette. This is a Marian conference. I'm going to say, I want to tell these stories, they are, the truth, so help me God, but I invite you not to believe them, really, because I would really hate for anyone to think they're supposed to believe these stories if they don't believe them. But anyway, the first day there, I take a walk. It's snowing really heavily. There's not much to do. I take a walk outside. There's a strong wind, so there's actually a rock which the snow was blown off of, so I could sit on the rock and stare down at this, 6 feet of snow at my feet. And I'm staring at the snow at my feet, And there are these two flowers that have pushed up through the snow. There's a pale pink one and a pale blue one on these long stalks coming up through the snow. And I look at these flowers and I say to myself, oh, that's interesting. This is the Alps. You know, they must have strange flowers up here. So I go back into the retreat house for lunch, and they seat you at these long tables with all the other, you know, all the other pilgrims. And so I just say to the people across from me, oh, what kind of flowers is it that they have up here that grow in the snow? You know, and they just like look at me like I'm nuts and don't answer. It was like, it was years later before I realized that I think that was a miracle. And the other thing that was happening in those 2 weeks was I could barely stay awake. I would wake up for meals and essentially probably sleep about 21 hours a day. I mean, I would get up for meals and immediately afterwards just, you know, have this tremendous drowsiness and want to take a nap. And so I was spending almost the entire time napping. And I thought, well, there's something wrong with this. You know, this is really bad. And so I remember once I was sleeping away the afternoon and I said, well, this is silly. I'm going to force myself to get up. So I kind of forced myself to get up at 45 degrees in the bed, you know, and prop up the pillows and force myself to sit up and force my head up and try to shake off the sleep and wake up and fail, and my head falls back on the pillow and I fall asleep. And I fall into this dream, and in this dream, the dream takes place in a service station, right? There's a car up on the lift, and there are three mechanics working on each of the four wheels. So there are 12 mechanics working on this car, right? And there's a shop steward, right? And to make it short, I'm the car, the shop steward is the Blessed Virgin Mary, the car is trying to get down off the lift, and Mary yells at it saying, what are you doing? We're still working on you. We're not finished yet. And I understood from that dream that why I was napping so much, that, you know, she was still working on me. They weren't finished yet. So I stopped trying to force the sleep. So I spent the rest of the time there. I'll tell one more dream, which was, it's the end of my stay. It's, you know, I have a plane back from Geneva the next day or 2 days later. So I drive back to Geneva. I spend the last night before the flight on the couch of a friend in Geneva. And I'm sleeping there. Before I go to sleep, now I'm going to confess something. I'm sure none of you do it, but, you know, it's like, you know, you want to think that prayer is a really wonderful, exalted thing, but half the time my prayer ends up being whining, right? So this was one of those whining prayers where before going to sleep, I'm kind of praying but really whining, God, how can you do this to me? I go halfway around the world to ski. It would have been the best skiing of my life, right? Because 3 feet of snow was falling every day for that whole trip. Would have been the best powder skiing of my life, and you don't let me go skiing. You stick me at La Salette and trap me there for the whole time, right? So this is like my prayer before I go to sleep. So then I have this dream, a very awake-feeling dream, and in this dream, this man is speaking to me, and he's kind of like, you know, what, that stern but loving high school teacher, I mean, that has a kind of stern face and is kind of severe, but you know inside he's really full of love. And he just looks at me and kind of drills me with his eyes, and he says, you can go skiing or you can work for the second coming. It's your choice, which you choose. So, anyway, I felt about 2 inches tall, and I know what I chose. And anyway, so then I go back. Now, where am I? I'm back home. I know I want to be Catholic. I still, at this point, I only want to be Catholic because I frankly want to receive communion. I still don't believe most of the teaching. Let me just think for a moment where I should go with this. Okay, I'll tell one more story. which is okay. Now you got to. I still don't know anything. Okay, I still don't know any dogma. I'm still have my head full of these crazy ideas which I picked up when I was traversing the New Age, you know, during that year before the Dream of Mary. I'm still rebelling against the teaching of the Church, but I'm in love with Mary and I want to receive communion, and I know that all of this stuff is real. I met someone at La Salette who told me I should check out the Carthusians. Does anyone here know who the Carthusians are? They are the strictest contemplative order in the Church. Every Carthusian monk lives in solitary confinement, no speech for their whole lives. They eat one meal a day. They never sleep more than 3 hours at a stretch. They go to bed at about 9 and they wake up at midnight every night of their lives for divine office. They pray in choir from like midnight to 3 and then they sleep again from 3 to 6. No communication, and everything's in their cell. I mean, it's solitary confinement except for necessary activities. And they tell me, this woman I met at La Salette told me about the Carthusians and that I should check them out. And I said, hey, this makes sense because I got to find somebody who understands what's happening with me. And if anyone understands what's happening with me, it's going to be one of these guys. Because either they live a life of mysticism, you know, or they go crazy, right? Which is true. I mean, in other words, they obviously have to have a very deep, very profound interior life to sustain that life in joy. So this woman gave me the phone number of a Carthusian monastery near where she lived. So I called them up. Now, at the time, I didn't know that they took a vow of silence and they never spoke, right? So I just called the number. And by the way, I'll backtrack a little. I'm still really full of arrogance, okay? Because you got to remember, I was a Harvard Business School professor at 29, right? So, you know, I was really an arrogant SOB. I'm just beginning to get over it now. So I just call them up. And somebody answers the phone. I don't know, I didn't realize at the time, but it was the prior who, you know, is why he could speak on the phone. And I say, may I take a retreat there? I'd like to come and visit and take a retreat there. And he said, oh, no, it's absolutely impossible. We're strictly cloistered. We don't receive anyone. You know, we live completely in isolation. Then he says, tell me something about yourself. So I start telling him the story. And he obviously starts to waver, so I say, should I send you a letter? And he says, yeah, that would be a good idea. So I send him a letter, and he immediately writes back, anytime you want, you can come and visit. Now, what I didn't know at the time is, of course, that one exception to not receiving anyone is if they think it's a vocation. So I went there, and I really was kind of in heaven there. It's a long story. I flirted with that vocation for about 3 years until I discerned definitively in the negative. But I'll just tell one story there, which is I'm still Jewish, right, when I go there. I'm still not baptized. I still don't believe in, you know, 90% of the church, certainly of the church teachings. But I'm really in love with Mary, and I feel Mary's presence there very strongly. And the monks are joyful. And this is a very sterile atmosphere. They eat very badly. They eat very little. They bathe very little, in fact. They're only allowed to bathe once a week. I mean, it's a kind of place where, as a materialist, you think that people would be miserable and glum all the time. And instead, they look like kindergartners sharing a joke. And I knew that it was the presence of Mary. I knew that they weren't living without a female presence. They weren't living without the beauty and gentleness and love that comes from womanhood. They had it in spades because they had it from Mary. And I would be really happy just like cutting the grass with a scythe there and stuff because, you know, I felt like I was doing it out of love for Mary. So I'm doing that. I'm cutting the grass one day in the fields. And this elderly monk hobbles out to talk to me. Now, one of the problems is they're not allowed to talk, right? So when they have a chance to talk where it doesn't look like they're going to get caught, some of them are eager to take advantage of it. So this monk hobbles out to me, and he shyly says, tell me, you know, we couldn't help noticing, you're not Catholic, are you? You don't receive communion, you're not Catholic, are you? I said, no. And he said, well, then tell me, what are you? And I said, I'm Jewish. And he said, oh, that's a relief. We were all afraid you were Protestant. And so this experience at the Carthusian Monastery did two or three things that really warned me to the Catholic Church. I'll tell one other thing that I did that warned me to the Catholic Church. The prior came to visit me every day to give me spiritual direction, and I expected him to try to sell me on the Catholic Church and that I should become Catholic. And at one point, I kind of invited it. You know, this is the New York Jew in me, okay, you know, kind of like, come on, you know, let me have it. So I kind of say to him, you know, you think I should become Catholic? And he said, just keep your eyes open and be honest with yourself. and follow where that leads you. And this so amazed me. This was so against everything that I had imagined and been taught, you know, about the heavy-handed conversion and so forth. The other thing was that these monks were spending 5 hours a day chanting the Psalms, and the Psalms are all about the Jews, right? Jerusalem, should I forget you? May my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth? I mean, here are all these monks who are spending their lives as wannabe Jews. So I left there much warmer towards the Catholic Church than when I arrived. I'll make the tail end of my conversion really quick. I saw the 10-minute sign. I want to respect that. Which was, so I wanted to come back, baptized. I still didn't believe in the dogma as I should. I do believe in it all now, of course. But I tried to find a priest to baptize me. I had very bad luck, or it was providence, but I got turned down several times. First I asked a prior at the monastery in France to baptize me, and he refused, saying rather coyly, you know, we monks don't find much occasion for baptism. I guess they don't have a lot of babies around. And then I went to a Trappist monk in Massachusetts, whose name the prior in France gave me, because this man in Massachusetts, a Trappist monk, had been a Jewish psychiatrist and psychiatry professor at Columbia University in New York before his conversion. And so I went to him to ask to be baptized. And he asked me, why do you want to be baptized? Now, I was actually I had a chip on my shoulder at this point. I was mad at him because what happened was I had shown up at the monastery. I was still this, you know, wunderkind business school professor in my own eyes, right? So, and he kept me waiting like 5 hours to see him, right? So I'm like, you know, have a little head of steam up. He finally comes to talk to me. And he says, so why do you want to be baptized? And I'm kind of already have lost my temper, so I figure, well, I'll let him have it. I'll tell him the truth. So I said, I want to be baptized because I want to receive communion, and you guys won't let me unless I'm baptized. Now, I thought he'd throw me out, right? Because I thought you'd have to say, well, I believe in the teaching of the Catholic Church, or I think the Catholic Church is the one true church, or all of that stuff. And I didn't. I just told the truth. And I thought he'd be mad and throw me out. And instead, he just nodded and said, aha, that's the Holy Spirit at work. So he still wouldn't baptize me. He quite correctly pointed out it was time for me to integrate myself in parish life, because my entire Catholic spirituality until this point had been around monasteries and monks and religious communities. And I had no sense, you know, for the lay Catholic life. So anyway, now I will just race to the end. I did find a wonderful, charismatic French-Canadian priest in my hometown of Cambridge to baptize me. I had never heard of a charismatic Catholicism at this point. I didn't know it existed. And I remember the feeling when he had this little prayer group and I went to, there were like six people there, right? And he started speaking prophecy, right? He started speaking like it was God speaking in the first person. And I was like I was just, you know, fell over in my chair, and I thought, this is the only person in the world who's ever done this, because I had never heard of any of that. But anyway, obviously I had found an excellent person to baptize me. He baptized me, that was 1992. I explored religious vocation for about 10 years, diocesan priesthood, religious orders. I kept getting a discernment in the negative once I got close. That seems to me the way God often works, is he likes, you know, he likes the early courtship, he likes the flirtation, and when it looks like it might get serious, then he lets you know that's not for you. Anyway, I was in agony because I knew I had a vocation of some sort. I knew I was supposed to do something. I was continuously in living this nightmare of, have I blown my vocation? You know, did I discern wrong? Was I supposed to do something that I didn't do? And boy, that's the other one speaking, by the way. I think many of you know that, I mean. But boy, does he run you in circles about that, telling you that you're a failure and you missed God's call for you, and you know, it's all over and you're washed up on the shore and all of that stuff. So he was having a good time with me for a long time with that line. But then about 2002, about 3 years ago, I was given this book to write. It's called Salvation is from the Jews, The Role of Judaism in Salvation History from Abraham to the Second Coming. And that's what it is. It's the role of Judaism in salvation history from Abraham to the Second Coming. And I knew, this book came very fast. I knew that this was what I was supposed to do. I've never had an experience like the experience I had writing this book. I wrote in about 5 months from start to finish, essentially as fast as I could type. I didn't even know what I was typing. I'd sit there on my word processor typing with my eyes glued to the screen saying, oh, I can't wait to see what happens next. I can't wait to see how this sentence ends. I'm not trying to sell the book, but I do have them outside to sell. And tomorrow's talk will be around the content of the book, which is the role of Judaism in salvation history from Abraham to the Second Coming. And just as a little bit of a teaser, let me say that the role of Judaism in the First Coming, it's very interesting, it's very profound, but in some sense it's a bit transparent. I mean, obviously, God needed to prepare somebody for the, you know, to host the Messiah when he came, and that was the Jews. And you can look at a lot about the Jews and see how it fits into that role. But then there's another really interesting issue, which is the role of the Jews in the Second Coming. And we do know from scriptural prophecy, mostly from St. Paul, but also from the words of Jesus himself, that shortly, the Second Coming, the last big stage before the Second Coming, will be the conversion of the Jews. Which is another reason why I am very excited about working for the conversion of the Jews, and I exhort your prayers to that end. So I want to be obedient, but I'll be back tomorrow, and thank you very much.
We have to talk, baby. Write down your phone number and email. Okay. Are you
coming up the whole time?
Yeah.
With Jewish brothers of New York. Oh, right, that's amazing.